Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to Nomads Past and Present, a podcast about nomadism and nomadic peoples around the world and throughout history. I'm your host, Maggie Freeman, and my guest today is Professor Chris Atwood. Chris is professor of Mongolian and Chinese Frontier and Ethnic History and chair of the Department of East Asian Languages and Civilizations at the University of Pennsylvania, where he teaches and conducts research on a wide variety of topics pertaining to Mongol history, culture, politics, and religion. Most recently, he published his new translation of the medieval epic, The Secret History of the Mongols, which is what we'll be talking about today. So thank you so much, Chris, for joining me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So first, just to locate listeners in the topic of our conversation, could you offer a very brief overview of the contents of The Secret History of the Mongols? Basically, what is it? How would you describe it in a couple sentences to somebody who is not familiar with it already? And maybe just a little bit about what we know about when and by whom it was written or might have been written.
Great. Secret History of the Mongols is the major source that we have on the life of Chinggis, also known as Genghis, although he's not the preferred Mongolian way to say it is Chinggis. Genghis is based on a bit of a misunderstanding. So it's the primary source we have on the rise of the Mongols, Mongol Empire, Chinggis Khan, and goes through the reign of his son Ökodei. And ends roughly around, you could say, around 1240. And so as the Mongol Empire has kind of reached pretty much close to its sort of maximum size, although there will be more conquest later under his Chinggis Khan's grandson Kublai and so on. The text is anonymous, and it's dated in a funny way. It's dated to the year of the mouse, so in the 12-year animal cycle. So, as you can figure out, unless we know exactly which 12 years that in, that's a little bit of a puzzle. For various reasons, which I talk a little bit about in the introduction to my translation, I'm a believer in the 1252 theory of the Year of the Mouse. That's to say that it was written in 1252, which would put it about 25 years after the death of Chinggis Khan and about 12 years after the latest events in it. Because there's actually a little bit of sort of foreshadowing of future events that come up. So that's the basic introduction to it. It's mostly in prose, but it has a lot of poetic passages. So that's your basic short introduction to The Secret History of the Mongols.
Great. And so you said it's the primary source for the kind of rise of Genghis Khan and the sort of earliest Mongol conquests. Why is that? Why is it the kind of text or the sort of most used, I hesitate to say kind of most reliable, because I'm sure that can be sort of questioned, but why is it kind of the most commonly referred to source for Mongol history?
There's a couple of reasons for this. The first reason is that it's the only one of the known histories of the Mongol Empire that was preserved in the original Mongolian language. It definitely has also a kind of richness of the Mongolian language, which most of the other sources don't have. There were, in fact, a lot of other Mongolian sources written, but because of the sort of fall of the Mongol Empire, they have been preserved for us mostly in Chinese or Persian translation. So they give you a lot of the good information that can be found there. But literarily and in terms of sort of giving you some of the nuances of the language, those Persian and Chinese translations are not as not as revealing as The Secret History of the Mongols, which is preserved in Mongolia. The other thing about it is that in terms of being a narrative history that really takes us from the ancestry of Chinggis Khan, and The Secret History of the Mongols actually starts with a very long genealogy that goes back into distant mythical time. But it takes us from that genealogy all the way up through the actual expansion of the empire, the conquest of places like Beijing, Kaifeng, Kiev, Baghdad, so on and so forth. As a single narrative history, The Secrets of the Monks is the earliest. We do have some other earlier sources that are in Chinese, which some of which I also translated in the, if I make a plug for my book, The Rise of the Mongols, Five Chinese Sources. Some of those are earlier than The Secrets to the Mongols, but they're not really connected narrative histories. We also have some Persian histories, a very famous one, Zhou Veini's history of History of the World Conqueror, is written just a few years after The Secrets to the Mongols. But again, it's very much focused on the Persian side. So if we take a history that is centered on Mongolia and sort of views both the sort of the Chinese eastern side of the Mongol Empire and the Iranian Persian western side of the Mongol Empire, views them evenly, The Secrets of the Mongols is definitely the earliest. And so it's really the earliest complete narrative history of the Mongol Empire. And I think that's the other reason that makes it particularly influential. I should also say it was read and used by later historians, either directly or indirectly. So it kind of established a lot of the narrative framework for viewing the Mongol Empire.
And so what do we know about the original context or original audience for which it was written? Was it intended to be sort of recited and heard orally? Would it originally have been written down and transmitted that way, or both?
Yeah, it was. Okay, so the final passage, there's at the end of the book, is what's called a colophon, which is a term that we use a lot of times in medieval language and literature. That gives the, it's sort of like, it's a little like the copyright information at the front of a book in a modern publishing system. In a colophon, it's at the end of a book. It just tells you where and when it was written down and so on. So I'm just going to read it right now. At the moment when the great Kodaltai was assembling in the Roebuck moon of the year of the mouse, and the hordes had been pitched at the seven hills of Kudur Isle on the Hirlin between Silgunchuk and blank, there's a missing word there, the writing was finished. So that's what it said. Now, to explain that a little bit, the Great Kodaltai was this big meeting that would happen in the Mongol Empire. They were periodic assemblies. This is something that there's a little bit of something of a debate among scholars. I think the evidence is very strong that actually a Great Kodaltai was simply any Kodaltai or assembly in which the emperor was present. And that would normally take place every summer. So every summer, in fact, there would be a great Kodaltai. Some people have argued that a great Kodaltai is only for exceptional events, like for crowning a new emperor. But I think the evidence speaks against that. So this great Kodaltai is an assembly at which the emperor is present. And that was when this was finished. That Roebuck moon, they months of the year were sort of numbered according to sort of events that happened. I guess roebucks were mating at that time, perhaps. But that was probably, again, Roebuck moon of the year of the mouse would be August 1252, roughly. So that is presented at a Kodaltai, at an assembly. And what we know from other sources on the empire is that the assemblies had kind of different types of sessions. In some sessions, they would be held in these very large, enormous kind of tents or sort of palaces. I mean, they, you know, to think some of them were sort of just solely for assemblies. Some of them were more in the sort of these sort of mobile palace tents. But in any case, they were very large and they could help hold hundreds of people. The key assemblies were held with only the elite of the empire present. And so we have a description of the assembly that enthroned Genghis Khan's son, Okudai. And it describes who was there quite nicely. It says basically the members of the imperial family, which would be basically Genghis Khan's descendants, his brother's descendants, And this would include both male and female. So these sons and grandsons and daughters and granddaughters. Also, everybody who married into the family. Mongols practice exogamy, so all of the women of the Mongol Empire had to the women of the imperial family had to marry non-imperial family men, and vice versa. So the daughters were the daughters and their sons-in-laws were also present, and finally and also the wives of the commanders. So we also know that there was everything was done very symmetrically. For every male on the right hand of the ruler, there would be his wife on the left hand side, and for every daughter of the ruler, there would be every female descendant of the ruler, there would be her husband would be on the right hand side. So they had that kind of, they would distinguish the seating by gender, so men on the right and women on the left. And then finally, there were the commanders of 1,000. Genghis Khan had organized his empire into this so famous decimal organization, 5, 10s, 100s, and 1,000s, and 10,000s. And it was those, but the key unit was commander of 1,000, and that was a hereditary position. Once he appointed you to commander of 1,000, that would descend hereditarily in your line. So this was kind of the new aristocracy of the empire. So that was the core audience of a Kurultai. And that was the core audience of the secret history of the Mongols. So other people, like, you know, people from papal envoys to Korean kings, all these other people in the Mongol Empire, they would be there, but they wouldn't be allowed into the secret sessions. So that's why it's a secret history of the Mongols, because the only people who would be listening to it were that core group of the imperial family, those who had married into the imperial family, and the commanders of 1,000 and their descendants. So that was the core evidence. One thing that's also important about the secret history of Mongols, as I mentioned, it was written in prose. And so it was certainly written. And this is something that it kind of has an epic feel about it. It's been called an epic chronicle, but I think that impression is somewhat misleading. Because the one thing we find, and this is something where I thought of my academic research has sort of informed my translation, is that there's actually a lot of verbatim citation from previously existing written sources in the Secret History of the Mongols, as well as a fair amount of poetry, which is formally, at least, quite similar to Mongolian narrative poetry as far as we know it, although actually Mongolian epics in the true sense, we don't actually have any evidence of them. The earliest recorded ones are from the 18th century, so much later. But so it's a very interesting mix of citations from written works and also then poetry. So it was, I would assume it was probably recited to the audience. Although, you know, Mongolian literacy was developing at the time, and was, we know that the Mongol Khans were Ogedei and his brothers and nephews and sons. They were all literate training in reading and writing was something. Genghis Khan himself was probably not literate, but he made sure that all of his sons and grandsons and probably many of his daughters and granddaughters were literate. They would be given tutorials by various figures from the surrounding peoples, as well as particularly the scribal class.
And so, you know, even though originally the text might only have been known to members of the Kurultai and to the kind of immediate elite of the Mongol Empire, obviously it didn't remain that way for very long. And as you said, it was cited and referenced and used by other historians contemporaneously. So what do we know about how it sort of filtered out beyond the Kurultai? How is it transmitted or accessed by later or kind of contemporaneous historians?
That's a great question. The beginning of it probably happened about, so the Secrets of the Mongols was first presented, according to the scenario, in 1252, in the year of the mouse. About 25 years after that. So it's interesting. It's always just sort of jumps. So Genghis Khan dies in 1227. 25 years later, Secrets of the Mongols is written. About 25 years after that, Genghis Khan's grandson, Kublai Khan, who is ruling in what's now Beijing and the city that he was calling Daidu, he wants... The Secrets of the Mongols is still secret, but he wants to have something that's kind of based on it, but that would be more public. And therefore, he's going to have to expurgate some of the more controversial bits, we can call them. So they have the naughty bits have to be taken out, but sort of the public record has to be changed. He also wanted to add in some other Mongolian sources and clean up the chronology a bit. The Secret History of the Mongols has an interesting, it's a somewhat lax chronological approach. So you need to clean that. So he then produced something which survives in a Chinese translation and in a Persian paraphrase, sort of expanded paraphrase. And that work, which we can call the Authentic Chronicle of Genghis Khan, which the Chinese version of it would be Taizu Shilu. So again, the only was survived is in the Chinese, but we also have it was also used by the famous Persian historian of the Mongol Empire, Rashid ad-Din, around 1304. So it was actually through that conduit that the basic narrative framework of the Secret History of the Mongols kind of was sort of distributed to the broader population. We do know it probably was also, some historians talk about, like Rashid ad-Din himself talks about, there are these histories of that the historians of the Mongols have, and they say this or they say that. It's like he's almost like people were reading it to him and gave him sort of oral sort of summaries of the kind of information. And the Secrets of the Mongols may have sort of distributed that way. But during the time of the Mongol Empire, the actual text itself appears to have remained basically secret. It was only after the fall of the Mongol Empire, the fall of the Mongol Empire, we usually mean in 1368, the Mongol Empire, the Great Khan in what is now Beijing, got kicked out and he fled back to Mongolia, and the new Ming Dynasty, which was an ethnic Chinese dynasty, took power. At that point, somewhere around that point, the Ming Dynasty had found a text of this Mongolian, and they thought this was really interesting. They also needed to train their interpreters and things like that to deal with the Mongols north of the border. So they took this Mongolian language text and transcribed it with Chinese characters, not paying attention to the meaning, but just according to the sound, syllable by syllable. It's like, what a lot of work. And that took place around 1385. And then that got printed in Chinese. They sort of printed it, not so much for the broad masses to use, because it was kind of a weird text for a Chinese to read. And it did have, each word had like the Mongolian pronunciation syllable by syllable, and then to the side of it, it would have what it meant in Chinese. But so the grammar was all Mongolian grammar. So then it had like brief Chinese summaries. So that text was block printed, probably for use by these interpreters, who would sort of, you know, they would do sort of official use for them. And that was preserved into the 18th, 19th century when scholars began to study it. Another version of the text also was probably carried back into Mongolia. It seems to have circulated in Mongolia, or maybe also, remember, there was also still, even after the Mongol Empire, there were still a lot of Mongolian speakers in what's now Beijing. They were people who had been there at the time of the Mongol Empire, and they, not all of them went back to Mongolia, so they're still there. So we're not sure exactly where it was preserved, but there was another Mongolian text in the Mongolian script, and that eventually, in the 1660s, got incorporated into a Mongolian chronicle. About two-thirds of the text got sort of incorporated into a later Mongolian chronicle that had also a lot of other legendary elements, also kind of like translations of Buddhist history from Tibet. It was a real grab bag. So fortunately, into that grab bag, they threw two-thirds of the text of the Secrets to the Mongols. So we ended up, when we study the Secrets to the Mongols, there are therefore three sources that we can use. First of all, we have that version under Kublai Khan that was sort of you could say, Baudelaireized, a sort of expurgated version of The Secrets of the Mongols. But also, it also has some interesting new elements. That's this authentic chronicle of Genghis Khan. So that's one source that we use that is found in Chinese and Persian translation. Then we have the two editions, or recensions, you can call them, using a technical term, two recensions of The Secrets of the Mongols, one being the one transcribed into Chinese characters by sound with glosses, and the other being the one that was transmitted in Mongolia, about two-thirds of the text transmitted in Mongolia and attached into this Mongolian chronicle. So that's how it was. That's how we know about it today.
And so, given that the text was originally intended to be secret, is there a sense in the text, regardless, that the author was maybe aware of or was thinking about the fact that the text could at some point be accessible or would be used by people in the future? Is there a kind of looking to or speaking to people down the line visible within the text? You know, like, I think when we think about sort of more kind of canonical historical chronicles like Herodotus's or Ibn Khaldun's and figures like that, there's very clearly a writing to the future as well as to kind of the present moment. Is that sort of aim visible within The Secret History of the Mongols as well? Or is it really more written to kind of very contemporary, present kind of political and social needs?
That's a really interesting question. And I'm glad you brought that up. I think there are, I want to say the answer is yes. And I think maybe the answer is yes. But it's a really interesting mixture. Certainly the historian, the person who wrote this has a sense that there are particular events or things that need to be explained in Mongolian history. And as I point out in the introduction, there's a kind of phrase that comes up at the end of certain sections, and it sort of says, Yami Yamara Yosa Tim Bulage, or such and such. That was the way in which such and such happened. It's put in kind of interesting family history ways. Like, so how did Genghis Khan's mother first marry her father? It turns out that was through a kind of a capture. How did the Yurkin, which was this sort of rival house that was opposed to Genghis Khan, how did they have such a sort of genealogical grab bag of members, there was a reason. So this is, it comes in at the point when it's kind of explaining things that from context seem to have been, it sounds like that what it's saying is, this is some problem that you often, you a little Mongol kid in the 1240s growing up and taking your history classes, you couldn't quite figure that one out. And so now the secret historian's going to figure it out for you. So it kind of has that sense. And so there's certainly the sense of an ongoing historical conversation that predates the secret history. As I mentioned, the secret history also makes use of pre-existing written sources, some of which were narrative, although probably none of them had the scope of The Secrets of the Mongols. It's also looking forward to the, it kind of has a vision of the empire's history as a whole. As I said, it was written in 1252, and that's an important date because in 1251, one of the families of Genghis Khan's sons, he had four main sons, and each one of them established a kind of a imperial line within a sort of a subfamily within the overall imperial family. So in 1251, the subfamily of descendants of his fourth son, Tolui, seized power from the descendants of Genghis Khan's third son, Ögedei. The third son, Ögedei, had previously been the ruling family. But then the fourth son, Tolui, his son, Mönke Khan, who was Genghis Khan's grandson, he sees power from the other grandsons of the other house of the family. And there's a lot of things in The Secrets of the Mongols that kind of look forward to that and give that sort of picture of why this is going to be necessary. So it's definitely looking towards past historical issues. It's also looking forward to why it is that the empire kind of lost its way under Okude. He's not seen as a bad emperor entirely, but he's kind of mixed. It ends with this very odd four good things he did, four bad things he did, kind of testament from Genghis Khan's son Okude. And you can kind of see that this is sort of leading up to a real issue in which if Okude is not so good, what if he has really bad sons? And one of his Okude's sons, who is the third emperor, actually shows up in The Secrets of the Mongols, and he's a really bad character. It's sort of giving him, before he became emperor, he was a bad egg already. You can sort of see that that's going to become a problem. And so that's why in 1251, we're going to need the family of Toloi, who's always very good and self-sacrificing and heroic, needs to seize power. At the same time, I can't really point to a specific passage which it seems to be kind of for the ages, but the very scope of The Secretists of the Mongols, the fact that it is unique among all of these earlier sources and sort of going back to the very distant past and sort of taking that rise of the Mongol lineage through many, many generations, a very long genealogy with stories attached that sort of begins the work. I think the distant past rooting of it creates also a sense that this empire is going to last for quite a while. And it, in that sense, gives also a kind of picture of how do you renew the empire? How do you renew this ruling family if something has gone wrong? And that sort of happens several times in the course of it. We see these sort of problems between brothers. Brothers are fighting each other. How do we resolve that? How do we move beyond that to sort of reestablish the original vigor of the empire? And that's, I think, the message that the secret historian wants future generations to be. A future generation of Mongols to be hearing.
And do we have a sense of how common this kind of literary production would have been among the Mongols? You know, I think when we look to other nomadic communities, we very often find sort of professional poets or storytellers or people who kind of fulfill this function of maintaining and transmitting the sort of histories and traditions of that community. Would there have been a kind of corollary to that among the Mongols, an almost kind of professional historian and like court reciter? Is that who we can imagine maybe the secret historian as having been? Or would it have been maybe more realistically just sort of a member of the elite who told this story to members of the other elite in a more sort of informal way?
I think there almost certainly was. There's a few passages in The Secretists of the Mongols that where linguistically it reflects the it has passages that we can see in again these later epics. So as I mentioned, in the 18th century, ethnographers some people in the Russian Empire were sort of explorers and so on. They note the existence, and they actually record some of the texts that, of epics that were sung by the Mongols. And that epic tradition, we saw something called the Jangar tradition, which is among the Kalmuks of the far westernmost Mongols. And Saglar Bukdayeva has just made a wonderful translation of the of the Jangar epic in one of its that was sung in the early 20th century, earlier 20th century version of that. So so that tradition existed, and it probably existed earlier on in going back into the 13th century and so on. One of the interesting things about it, though, is that the Mongolian epic tradition doesn't use historical characters, unlike, say, the Greek or the old French historical tradition, where at least we can speculate that maybe Agamemnon was a real historical king, or Roland and Charlemagne, they appear in the Song of Roland and so on. In Mongolian epics, the figures are not historical. But they do certainly give you a kind of a narrative template of how to tell a story. And there's interesting phrases that can be found in The Secrets of the Mongols that reflect that. So at one point, when Chinggis Khan, he's been challenged for rule by this shaman figure, Tiptinger, and Tiptinger's father, Father Munklik, has been a very close intimate of Chinggis Khan's. And so this is kind of a challenge that comes from within the most intimately associated family associates of Chinggis Khan. So, and eventually Chinggis Khan lets his younger brother, Temüge Öcalan, kill Tiptinger in through a very interesting sort of way through a very clever, sort of slightly underhanded way. But then it says, when he heard that his son had been killed, Father Munklik understood and shed tears, saying, "From when the brown earth was no more than a bit of dirt, from when the broad sea was no more than a creek, I was a friend of the Khan." So brown earth was no more than a bit of dirt. The broad sea was no more than a creek. That's exactly a phrase that is used in Mongolian epics to say, once upon a time. It gives that's that way distant past. So the secretist in Mongols is certainly using that kind of epic traditions. At the same time, though, precise in that passage, it's aware of the epic traditions, but also subverting them. And it's subverting them in the sense of Mongolian epics, like those of the Turkic tradition, the Kyrgyz tradition, and like those of the Greek. And really, I think it's a kind of universal, maybe kind of defining feature of epics, that athletic competitions are seen as the guarantor of truth. So for those of you familiar with, say, the Odyssey, Odysseus is disguised when he comes back and he finds the suitors are harassing Penelope and they want to marry her. He comes back, he's disguised up until the point where they put a bow in his hands. And then he reveals himself, "I'm the hero," and then he kills all the suitors. And there's actually, interestingly enough, in later Mongolian historiography that gets kind of epicalized, like in the Precious Summary, which has also been recently translated by Johann Elverskog. In that, we see in later versions, we have like Chinggis Khan's brothers are sort of saying, "Why does Chinggis Khan get all the rule? Why does he get to do this? Why does he get all the good stuff?" And then Chinggis Khan disguises himself as an old man with a bow, and he gives the bow to his brothers and asks the brothers, "Can you string this bow? Can you fire it?" And they can't. But then the old man does, and he shows, "I'm Chinggis Khan. You know, this is why I get all the rule, because I'm better than you." So that's very epic. But in The Secrets of the Mongols, there are two athletic competitions, and both of them are rigged. The first one happens when Buribukhe, a member of this rival Yurkin house among the Mongols, sort of Chinggis Khan's distant cousins, and in that Buribukhe is had previously had an altercation with Chinggis Khan's younger half brother Bilgute, and he sort of cut his shoulder. Actually, I have to say, maybe he's younger half-brother. We always think of him as younger because he's junior, but he may actually be older. But that does maybe. I don't think anybody actually knows that date. But it's a very interesting so then later on, there is this issue. And so I'll just read the passage here. "One day, Chinggis Khan said, 'Let's have Buri the Brawny.'" But Buche, I call him Buribukhe, that's the Mongolian word for Buche, is like means wrestler, it's a big guy. So Chinggis Khan, that's I translate as Buri the Brawny. So Chinggis Khan said, "Let's have Buri the Brawny and Bilgute wrestle." Buri the Brawny was one of the Yurkin. Before, Buri the Brawny would seize Bilgute with a hand on one side and push with his other foot and make him fall, pushing him down without letting him move. Buri the Brawny was the brawniest in the kingdom. And then Bilgute and Buri the Brawny were made to wrestle. Buri the Brawny, a man who could not be beaten, took a fall for him. Belgote, unable to pin him, held him by the shoulders and got onto his butt. Belgote looked back, and just as he looked at Chinggis Khan, the Khan bit his lower lip. Belgote understood and moved up on his back, pulled the two sides of his collar in a firm crosswise grip, and put his knee on his spine until it cracked. Buddy the Brawny knew his spine was broken and said, "I would not have been beaten by Belgote. I was afraid of the Khan and took the fall, hesitating, and lost my life. Just then he died." Having snapped his spine asunder, Belgote dragged him off and threw him away. So Buddy thought, if I just give in and let Chinggis Khan's brother beat me, I'll save my life. But it didn't happen that way. And the same thing happens later with that Teptinger shaman guy. They're having a fight, and Teptinger had kind of been sort of abusive towards Chinggis Khan's brothers. And he actually kind of also using sort of telling Chinggis Khan, you know, your brother, one of your brothers is maybe going, Hasar is named Hasar, he's going to be maybe a threat to your kingdom, so on and so forth. But he starts attacking Chinggis Khan's brothers. And then there's a scene in the court where they're, you know, they start fighting each other. And then Chinggis Khan says, "Take it outside, guys," basically. But Chinggis Khan's younger brother, Temugochigan, had already stationed three guys outside. So they take it outside to fight it out like a man. And as soon as Teptinger goes out there, these three guys jump on him and kill him and probably snap his back the same way. And so in The Secrets of the Mongols, athletic contests do not reveal truth. They are fraudulent. And that's kind of, in a sense, I mean, and that's right in the kind of context, which is, I mean, wrestling is one of the big sports in Mongolia. And to show two wrestling matches and both of them have be fraudulent is kind of, it's subversive of the epic tradition. So The Secrets of the Mongols in a sense, yes, it is written with an awareness of the epic tradition, but it's also kind of subverting it and putting out, I think, an idea about rule, which is much more, you could say, ironic, covert, much less about, you know, speaking your mind and being very forthright, and much more about sort of, it's very interesting when Chinggis Khan, much more about messages that are unspoken. It's very interesting in that passage I read about Buddy the Brawny. Belgutai, he looks to his half brother Chinggis to, what do I do now? I've got him on the ground. What do I do now? And he looks in Chinggis Khan, he bites his lower lip. No words are spoken, but Belgutai gets it. So as people have pointed out in epics, there's a tendency towards, you know, the Achilles or Manas or some of these great epic heroes from the Central Asian Kyrgyz tradition, they're always talking and they're always saying things. In a sense, there people have talked about the exteriority of epics. Epic personalities are people who say what they think. And therefore, by recording their speech, you find out what they're thinking. In The Secrets of the Mongols, there's a lot of talking, but the key things are never said. Key things are never actually made clear through speech. You just kind of have to get them through. Pay attention to what they do, not to what they say. So The Secret History of Mongols has this very interesting relationship to the epic tradition. At the same time, it is also, as I mentioned, it's part of a, there was a written tradition that was going on in The Secret History of the Mongols times. As I mentioned, probably from around the 1230s onwards in the reign of Okude, Chinggis Khan's son, people began to write biographies, and these were very important because the biographies would talk about how your father, maybe you or your father, your great-grandfather, probably not great-grandfather, but maybe grandfather at the most, had participated in helping found the empire. And therefore, that gave you claim to a certain number of subjects, claim to a certain kind of regular payments from the from the imperial taxes that would come to you as gifts from the emperor, from the Khan, and so on. So there was really important to get that down in writing. And we have instances in the 1230s where Okudai would look to some of these biographies and say, hey, look, it says that guy X had bigger achievements than you did. And so guy, and yet he's been, guy X has been assigned less subject people than you have. I'm going to boost your stuff and cut down their stuff to make you even. So people would use these biographies to actually, change the amount of privileges they would have. So obviously, once people see that happening, then they got to get this stuff written down ASAP. So the biographies were being written. We also have some interesting kind of early histories. But, you know, there was a fair amount of being written. Again, I think more than we realized, because almost all of it has survived only in Chinese and Persian translations. They didn't survive in Mongolian, although we also have some, we have some fragmentary ones that have been found in manuscripts. But still, I think one of the striking things that the secret historian does seem to be a bit of a genius. This, there doesn't seem to be something of that same scope in the Mongolian, preceding Mongolian or contemporary Mongolian literary tradition until after the secret historian puts it all down in one big story.
That's fascinating. What you said about how so much of the important moments of the text are kind of implicit or are the things that are unspoken, I think totally went over my head when I was reading it. So that just totally changed my perception of the text. It's really interesting. We've been talking about how the secret history in a lot of ways kind of sets out to define Mongol identity at this moment in time and to kind of define sort of legitimize, you know, the Chinggisid Empire. But there are also these really interesting, or what I thought were really interesting moments in the text where that identity is defined in opposition to other peoples around the Mongols. You know, there are references to the Tatars and the Chinese and what you call in your translation, the forest folk. And I'm really interested in how those kind of outsiders to the Mongols, or the peoples who are kind of against and around the Mongols, how are those kind of other groups portrayed in the secret history?
Well, right. So it's really interesting. So for example, the forest folk, there's these interesting pictures of forests, and the secret historian really seems to have not really liked forests very much. And this appears to be actually reflecting we have other passages where this is reflected. A famous passage about it is one where Chinggis Khan is at Temujin at this point, and he is. Let's see if I. Yeah, so he's. Up and going through the sort of the mountains, and he talks about going into a place that was so so narrow, even a glutted, so in between trees that were so grown so thickly, a glutted snake could not get through them. And that phrase actually appears later in a Persian history. They're talking about some forest in the Caucasus, and they say the Mongols came up to this forest and it was so thickly grown, a glutted snake could not get through it. And it's exactly the same metaphor. And I'm sure that comes into the Persian history again. They're quoting from a Mongolian source. So whenever this is what Mongols say when they have really thick forests. But, you know, I've been in the forests of Mongolia and they're not that thick. Actually, I think forests oftentimes call them understocked. That is to say, they're not really, it's not like the Olympic National Forest in Washington State. It's not like the Amazon. But it seems that the secret historian was used to, you know, the broad step and going out being able to see for miles. And so even a little bit of forest was kind of really bothered them. And of course, it's also some sense of the forest are sort of dangerous. Some key people like Borghold, who was one of Genghis Khan's great captains, was very beloved. He like dies, and they're sort of cutting their way through this this forest. Let me see if I can pull up that one. So they Borghol has been killed, and so now Genghis Khan has to send out this guy called Durbe the Fierce, Durbe Dokshan, and he is this sort of hyper disciplinarian. So Genghis Khan says to him, instead he appointed Durbe the Fierce of the Durban, decreeing, marshal the soldiers sternly, pray to eternal heaven, and take on the challenge to subdue the Tomat. The Tomat are one of these forest folk. So once Durbe had marshaled the soldiers, he first made empty feigns at the passes and paths where the army might go and which the scouts might be guarding. So kind of like decoys. But he issued ordinances for the soldiers to go along trails made by bison. As for the people numbered in the army, each man was made to bear blows of 10 switches of lash if his heart failed. They were to be trained at the axe, adze, saw, and chisel, and at men's weapons, and they were to hack and saw down the trees, standing in the trails, along the trails made by bison. When they had made a road and gone up into the mountains, they suddenly came down through the smoke holes of the Tumut folk, plundering them while they were seated at a feast. So you get this, they're like to kind of hack their way through forests to get at these forest folk. So that's definitely a kind of a statement about how the steppe Mongols viewed the forest folk. There's another funny also passage, which I really like, where the Naaman, these are in the West, sort of in central Mongolia and in western Mongolia at this time, there were two relatively large-scale conquests. There were two relatively large-scale kingdoms. And it was really important for Genghis Khan to conquer those kingdoms, and by doing so, he could kind of unify Mongolia. But those kingdoms looked toward, Genghis Khan had risen in the eastern part of Mongolia. And those kingdoms, they looked on the Mongols in the east as kind of like really, really kind of unpleasant. And so there's a very famous, very wonderful passage where the wife, the empress of the Naaman, talks about how she talks about the Mongols, and so we see the Mongols. It's kind of one of these interesting passages where a Mongol writer seems to be enjoying the disgust that the Mongols would raise in these other super civilized peoples, the Naaman. So, and so the Gurbasu, who has an interesting later career in Mongolian folklore, she is telling her, he's telling her husband, Tayan Khan, about what to do with the Mongols. His stepmother, Gurbasu, said, "What would you do with them? The Mongol folk have an evil odor, and their clothes have dark stains. Keep them far away. Maybe bring in the noblest of their daughters and daughters-in-laws. Wash their hands, and maybe they might be set to milk the cows and sheep." So these guys, these Mongols, are all country bumpkins. They're of evil odor. Their clothes are stained. They're smelly. And so eventually, of course, Genghis Khan, then when he wins over the Naaman, he says to Gurbasu, "Ah, you thought it was smelly. Now I'm going to make you my concubine, and I will humiliate you by making you be the concubine of this smelly guy of the Mongols." So there's a real sense of the Mongols as being, they revel in their image of we're the poor, the poor, simple folk. Later on, Jamak also says about the Mongols, "We Mongols are people who, when they say yes, they mean yes." And again, when you actually read The Secrets of the Mongols in context, it's like, yes, the Mongols may have a feeling of themselves like that, but you know what? There's an awful lot of deception going on in The Secrets of the Mongols. There's a very awful lot of people, well, maybe not lying, but not telling the whole truth, or, again, keeping their own counsel and not being explicit about what their aims really are.
Really interesting. So sort of along the lines of, you know, the things in the text that are maybe implicit or that are left unsaid, I can imagine would pose real challenges to a translator, that so much of, like, as you've said, so much of what's maybe really crucial or important in the text is sort of between the lines. I'd love to just talk a little bit, you know, as we're coming up on the end of our time, just talk a little bit about your work as a translator in your translation of The Secret History. And so, you know, I guess I'd like to ask, you know, why publish a new translation? What were your sort of goals or aims with this translation? What do you think or hope that a new translation offers to the contemporary reader?
Thanks. That's a great question. There are three earlier translations into English, and there's also lots of translations to other languages. There's been ones to German, into French, into Russian, Chinese. In addition to the original one, there's also back in the 1385 or so, there's also modern translation. And there's lots of modern Mongolian paraphrases. The language of the secrets of the Mongols for Mongolians today is, you know, a little bit like, say, maybe Chaucer in English. And there's a lot of words that are no longer used in Mongolian, so Mongolians paraphrase it. Demdin Surin, the famous scholar and poet, Demdin Surin, wrote a the most famous paraphrase in 1947, I think. And that's the one that is used in schools today. And when most Mongolians read The Secrets of the Mongols, that's actually what they're reading. The translation, the question, so why a new one? Partly because it's a very practical thing. I teach The Secrets of the Mongols, and all of the other translations are either out of print or really expensive. So I can't get people to buy them. I can't get the students to buy them. I want them to have a copy of them.
So that's really going above and beyond for your students.
Yeah. So the other reason, of course, was that over time, as I worked on it, I began to become – there are a lot of little things about the translations, that existing translations, that bother me more and more. In terms of little things, one thing is that there's actually, as scholarship has progressed, there's a lot of, the Mongolian alphabet it's an alphabet. It's ultimately derived from Aramaic. So it's from the Middle East, but it's an alphabet. The trouble is it has certain ambiguities, like so D and T and K and G are written the same, O and U are written the same way. So in terms of, as scholarship has progressed, we've gotten a better sense of, like, exactly how is this name written? So Genghis Khan's father's name, a lot of times people read it Yisuge with a G, but in fact we know it's certainly Yisuke with a K. So the K is going to kind of, in modern Mongolian, becomes a little more kh. So there's some changes along those lines. So that was one thing. And sometimes it's a little bit more significant than that. There are certain names that have been, like, literally not recognized who they really are because they're disambiguated in the wrong way. But at a more fundamental level, one of the features of The Secrets to the Mongols is, first of all, at a sort of larger level, there is this, you know, implicit knowledge sort of thing, this things unspoken. And previous translators, particularly Igor de Rakowitz, whose translation in many ways was sort of, is very helpful for me. I mean, his commentary, he's got this huge two-volume commentary, was something that I was using constantly. I made so many different choices by him, but I want to say that I respected his translation tremendously and his scholarship tremendously. But he had this sort of attitude that, speak out everything that's implicit. I mean, that's what, and I think, and that came in little ways and in big ways. Well, so for example, one of the funny things that Genghis Khan's father had two wives. One was Genghis Khan's mother, Mother Ulin. The other one was this woman who, in the secrecy of the Mongols, is never named. And, And that's not accidental. This is expressed. There's a kind of well, I think the secret historian was really didn't like the mother, the other woman in Yusuke's life. And so she's never named. And when she appears, she's given a very sort of humiliating appearance, actually. But Igor Arakawil found in a later Mongolian chronicle what he thought was the name of this person. I actually don't think it is. But he thought, oh, well, I should put that into the text because, you know, it's more complete that way. But that's actually, literally, that doesn't work because the namelessness is part of the point. So the other thing is also, the Secret of the Mongols has a lot of, as I discuss a little bit in the afterwards, sort of on translating it, the Secret of the Mongols has a lot of what's called, linguists call paratactic concatenation. What do I mean by that? It's when you put sentences together with and, with semicolons. Genghis Khan went, he did this, and then he did that, and then he did this, and then he said that, and then he did this. As opposed to hypotactic concatenation is where you use special phrases to subordinate one clause to another. Because Genghis Khan thought about this, therefore he did that while also doing the other thing in order to achieve his aims. So in that second one, I've given you all the logical connections. I've made it explicit for you. And one of the features of the Mongolian language, the secret history language, is that, and this is also compared to later Mongolian, it's also very hypotactic. There's all these logical connections are being drawn. If you read some of these later Mongolian decrees or histories from the 17th, 18th century, it's very, very logical and sometimes, you know, sort of very complex. But in the secret history of the Mongols, it's not like that. It's most and. In Mongolian, that's literally what's called the imperfect converb. In modern Mongolian, in classical Mongolian, it would be ju, the ju ending, which links verbs up like that. So comparatively, my translation uses much more paratactic concatenation in English, much more and, or semicolon. I found semicolons were my friend in this one. It's very useful. You can put them together very nicely in that sense. It kind of implies logical connection, but it doesn't necessarily mean logical connection. You've got to kind of think it out. And I had Nick Kapoor, who was a colleague at Rutgers in Camden, he was really, he gave a wonderful read for it. And he was kind of pushing me to be more explicit. And at some points, you know, but also sort of, you know, make it more readable for the English reader. And I really benefited from his advice. And a lot of times I did try to do that. But I also felt at certain points, no, I have to keep this ambiguous. I have to keep this, like, unclear. So, for example, in that passage I read where Father Munglik says he understood and then said, you know, from the time when brown earth was a clod, from when the broad sea was a creek, I have been, you know, I've been in your service. Understood what? What do you understand? And at that point, you know, he understood that I've devoted my whole life to this guy who's eventually going to kill my son without, you know, without so much of a second thought? Or did he just understand my son is dead? Did he understand that my whole family is going to be enthralled to this sort of kind of out of control imperial family forever? Who knows what he understood? That's the thing of the text. That's the way the secret history is speaking, is to not be explicit about that. So I at that point I just said, I'm going to just, he understood, and I'm not going to tell you what he understood. Probably because I don't really know. Nobody, you know, and sometimes I can guess, but I'll let the reader guess along with me rather than tell the reader what the reader should be guessing.
That's fascinating. I don't think I picked up on any of those kind of challenges within the text when reading the translation, which I think is a testament to the quality of the translation, that you sort of make it seem easy and effortless to produce this translation, although I'm sure it was not. So thank you so much for coming on to talk to me about The Secret History of the Mongols and your work translating it. I really enjoyed reading it as a non-Mongolianist. You know, it was a very just enjoyable read, but listening to you talk more about it and about your work now, I think really just opened up the world of The Secret History even more for me. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Maggie. It was really, really enjoyable talking with you.